Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable here with my two partners in crime, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now runs our payment integrity team, and Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now a manager on our SIU team. And today we want to, we're trying to stay away from controversial topics because things today are really just, let's be honest, they're terrible. We're so polarized right now. And it's very hard to have conversations with people that are maybe not political, but then ultimately have a political spin to them. And so it's terrible in the sense that it's very challenging to have conversations with people. You used to be able to say you can have a conversation about new sports and weather. The problem is that new sports and weather have now even become polarizing about things. But one topic that has come up that we want to talk about is there was an article the other day in the Wall Street Journal that talked about this issue involving double payments going out to Medicaid plans around the states. And the Wall Street Journal wrote this, very lengthy article about $400 or $500 million in double payments that are going out. And what they're talking about is Medicaid members. Sometimes they're called beneficiaries, sometimes they're called recipients, sometimes they're called members, but people who are the recipients of Medicaid from the state that they're living in will move to a different state, establish residency, and begin to receive services for Medicaid in the state that they've moved to without notifying, canceling, or doing anything to their original Medicaid. And for those of you that know Medicaid, most Medicaid in most states are MCO or managed care organizations. And so they work similarly to Medicare Advantage or commercial in these capitated payments, meaning that the providers, the Medicaid program gets 50% of its money from HHS, sometimes more depending upon the state you're in. And then that money gets disseminated out to the MCOs that contract with the state, because when it's not fee-for-service, just like anything else, it's commercial payers that have a contract with the state to provide those items, services, and procedures on behalf of the enrollees. And that money goes to those MCOs, and then the MCOs pay out that money to the providers. And so, for example, if I'm living in New Jersey and I have Medicaid and I move and I change my residence and I meet the requirements for Medicaid and I move to Florida, I then get Medicaid in Florida. But if I have not told the state of New Jersey that I'm no longer in New Jersey, Medicaid is still paying the MCO that I was under for those capitated services or those payments. And so the Wall Street Journal did this very lengthy article where they found, $400 or $500 million in potential payments that were double payments. And obviously, that's a fraud, waste, abuse issue, because one state is getting paid for a patient that's, a member that's not there. And the reality is that there was an OIG study done for, I think, years 1919 and 1920. It was put out by the Office of Evaluation and Inspection in 2022 that addressed this exact same thing. So this is not a reiteration. The reinvention of the wheel here was done by the Wall Street Journal to an extent. And if you read the article, they actually talk about the article. In the article, they actually talk about the study that was done. And I think if you read the article, the take home is, we're now in 2025, it's 3 years later, and nothing has been done. And when you pull up the OE&I study, OE&I studies always have at the end a recommendation, right? Because the OIG's job, not just HHS OIG, but OIGs in general, their job is to not only, from where Matt, Wade, and I came from, the badge and gun and ferreting out criminal, civil, and administrative fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance malfeasance, but the OIG as a watchdog is there to help ferret out fraud, waste, abuse, and program weaknesses. And when OE&I and Office of Audit Services do a lot of the work they're doing, they're really trying to conduct empirical tests on the veracity of a policy or an NCD or a rule, something that's out there. They're doing an empirical test, a stress test, so to speak, to identify, did the program do what it was supposed to do? And so OE&I did this study, and then at the end, they make recommendations to CMS. And every year, HHS OIG, as well as other OIGs, so it's not just HHS, they all do these studies, And at the end, they all publish a list of the top 10 unimplemented recommendations. Now, for HHS, most of those, if not all of those unimplemented recommendations, target program-related things for CMS, because CMS is the largest in Medicaid, largest entitlement program going on, and oftentimes the budgets for Medicare and Medicaid rival that of the Defense Department, for example. And so it should go without saying that when OE&I or OAS do these sort of empirical analyses, most of the time these studies target Medicare, Medicaid-related programs. Go to the work plan. Take a look at the OIG work plan and look what they're looking at. And when you look at the work plan, you're going to see most of that work is in the Medicare, Medicaid space. And so this was a study that was done in 1919, 1920, came out in 22, showed that this was an issue. They looked at 47 states plus the District of Columbia and I think a few other places and identified that this was, in fact, a systemic problem, made a recommendation for CMS to tighten up their data, share the data among states, so that the states can do their own reviews and find this. And CMS did not concur with OIG's direction on this. And so this kind of gets to a broader discussion that I want to start with, which is that when you're talking about program weaknesses, so at the OIG, we had the ability to do something called management implication reports, or as everything else in government has an acronym, a MIR. And we were encouraged as agents to do management implication reports. When you're working on an investigation and you find a program weakness, you're encouraged to write about it and identify what the problem is in your resolution. Similarly, in the SIU space, that should exist, right? So Wade, let's talk about that, because at the end of the day, you find something that needs fixing. You should make a recommendation about it being fixed, and you should be able to do some follow-up. And this really gets to the heart of, as an investigator, you're kind of at that first level of being to identify, hey, this happened, and why did it happen? What can we do to fix it? But then also that collaboration that needs to occur as a result of that. And so this is one of those things where it's not really a collateral effort from an investigator. It's kind of intrinsic in what an investigator should do. So talk a little bit more about management implication reports, but then I really want to focus on why the SIU version of a management implication report is just as important in the Medicaid and the commercial space from an investigator's perspective.
Right. And as you said, not only were MERS like encouraged for agents, but they were kind of required. It was part of the agent's like end of the year appraisal. Not that there was like a quota or anything like that, but if there were no MERS at all for the year, that was definitely going to be a question on, you know, let's keep this in the back of your mind. If you're seeing these issues, this is a good opportunity to address them. And it's issues that otherwise would not be uncovered because it's the agents, or it's, you know, the MERS come from, as you said, OI, OAS, Office of Audit Services, and OE&I. So investigators, auditors, and evaluators are the ones that are in the weeds, as we say, working these cases, doing these studies. So they're gonna uncover systemic issues, risks, or inefficiencies that otherwise probably would not be exposed. So the MER is an opportunity to kind of shine a light on those issues and address them. So the whole system is set up where initially it's somewhat of a templated form, but basically, as you said, you identify a systemic issue that you've uncovered in your investigation or your audit. And then the second equally important part is to make recommendations for improvement. It's like the think tank kind of theory where there's no stupid ideas or answers. So you're trying to throw up ideas on how to address these systemic issues. The form is submitted to, you know, OI management. There was somebody in headquarters, probably a small department that just handled these. They're reviewed and they're either declined. A lot of times they're declined, mainly because that issue is probably already being addressed in another MER that's maybe further along. Sometimes they're accepted for review. It may be the same issue that other people have been doing MERS on, but it's got a different angle on it or different recommendations. And then at the end of the accepted ones being reviewed. They're either implemented or not implemented, as you said. And there may be multiple MERS for really the same issue. I know that I've had agents who kind of tried to take credit for a MER that was implemented and say that was my MER, but there were multiple MERS addressing the same issue, just with different recommendations. But again, it's something that we really encouraged agents to do because they have a unique perspective on the angle that they're seeing these issues, and the recommendations are kind of independent from other, you know, the management is looking at a 30,000 foot view as opposed to the agent being in the streets, on the ground, you know, knee deep in it. So as you said, that's like a system that the OI agents go through, and there's not an equal system in the SIU departments and the MCOs. Even though there's not a MER system in a templated form that they use and, you know, encourage to be part of the agent's productivity and development, there's still the ability there for investigators to bring these same types of issues, systemic issues that they see that are a long-term problem, especially if they can come up with some type of idea on how to address it. And for that, you just need collaboration between the investigator, maybe the auditors, the different components working on the same issues within the SIU. But more importantly, you need buy-in from leadership. You need leadership to be willing to listen with an open mind and say, yeah, this is really an issue that's going to lead to fraud, waste, or abuse down the line. And now that we've addressed it and hopefully have some realistic recommendations for improvement, it's really up to the SIU management to kind of adapt that and be able to push it up their leadership chain to try and actually have some action to implement these recommendations to address the systemic issue. Again, not yet an official MER format, but you're still going through the same steps. You're identifying the issue, you're making recommendations for improvement, and hopefully those can be implemented, and down the line you might be able to show some ROI or really the result of those recommendations being implemented.
Yeah, and so the take home for this is that if an SIU doesn't have a version of a management implication report, a weakness identification report, call it whatever you want to call it, that is something that they should be thinking about doing, and then having a process in place where you write it up, you have the ability to show some evidence of why you think this is a problem, maybe even your recommendations for change or tightening it, and then the ability to track these and get follow-up, because that is an important piece of the puzzle. At the end of the day, somebody might not agree with your assessment, and that's fine, but it's at least you've done your part to be in a position to ensure that the work you're doing is actually valuable, because what you don't want is Groundhog Day, right? How many times are you going to see a case that involves X, Y, and Z where the provider is doing the exact same thing every single time, to do this? And so you've got to have that. So program weaknesses and program vulnerabilities are kind of part and parcel to the entirety of the payment integrity spectrum and understanding where these problems arise. I know that when I work cases, and I'm sure you guys did as well, you find these instances where you've got double payments going out. You've got Medicare making a double payment for something because it's a double billing case where they're doing something fraudulently to mask it's a double payment. Or an instance where you actually do find that the patient, the person in question may have gotten services and had Medicaid in another state or something like that. So Matt, I want to go to you because now this becomes like this whole CMS piece of the puzzle. So first of all, one of the arguments that has been made in the study that was done in the study that came out in 2022, where CMS did not agree with OE&I's findings, was that CMS's position was that this was burdensome to do this and that the data wasn't really where it should be. Now, in today's world, I can tell you definitively, and I know you know this, is that the data that was historically coming in from the states years past, which was known as MSIS data, Medicaid system or Medicaid something information system, was not normalized data and consistent. Every state kind of tracked their data differently. And over the years, CMS worked very hard with the states to get to a point where they now do what's known as TMSIS, the T meaning transformative, where that data is now consistent. So you can actually do apples to apples reviews because it's supposed to be in a fairly consistent manner. And so the question kind of begs itself in today's world of analytics and the magic words, AI, acronyms, AI and ML, how is it that this can still happen, right? And how is it that there's, I don't want to say a blind eye, but you know, you can see if I'm in New Jersey and I move to Florida and I change my address to Florida and I don't tell New Jersey, New Jersey doesn't know that. New Jersey's not looking at the property tax rolls. They're not looking at these things, right? So New Jersey doesn't necessarily know that I am no longer living in New Jersey, that I'm in Florida. And Florida may not know that I was getting Medicaid in New Jersey. But if through the power of data analytics, every state's data was available to every other state, you could do these checks and you can identify, hey, you still appear to be on the rolls of New Jersey when you're in Florida. Because right now it appears that the system that exists is that it is incumbent upon the recipient to be in charge of this. Now, if I live in New Jersey and I move to Florida and I still have family in New Jersey and I still travel to New Jersey frequently, why wouldn't I try to keep New Jersey Medicaid? Because as most people should know, Medicaid typically doesn't have an out-of-state benefit.
Correct.
So if I travel back and forth between New Jersey and Florida, why wouldn't I want to play this game, right? It's almost like doctor shopping to an extent. So talk about this, because so first of all, we know, Matt, that this happens. It does happen. It's continuing to happen. But we also know that this isn't new news. And we also know the UPICs have had an interest in looking at this for a long time.
Yeah, I'm going to try and break this down from my experience with the OIG, the UPIC, and now in the SIU world here at Advise. When I was with the IG, I was the one that was going through all of those MERS at the headquarters level. I was the one taking those things, seeing if they were duplicates of others, seeing what the recommendations were. Did they make sense? Were they supported by data across the country? Things of that sort. And then in our headquarters, we had liaisons with all of the departmental arms, CDC, NIH, FDA, CMS, ACF, all of the alphabet soup that falls under HHS, or at least did. And when a MER came in for a CMS or an ACF or an NIH issue, our inspector who had that liaison responsibility would take that MER once it was believed that it should go forward and would take that to the agency that was affected and say, here's this, here's our recommendations, what say you? And we would work with them to try to get those implemented. But I can tell you, 95% of the time, trash camp. I mean, they would say, thank you very much, we'll get to it, and we never heard another word about it. So it was, you know, implemented on our own because we took it over there and did what we had to do to recommend it. But then it was up to that departmental component to actually take the action. And we never saw 95% of it. We never saw any reaction to it. So that was OIG. UPICs, you know, we did, as a UPIC, we had multiple state jurisdictions. So we had access to multiple states' Medicaid data. You know, I was in the Northeast. We had it from D.C. to New York. Our Southeast was Florida to D.C., and that was the same company, SGS. So we looked at that cross Benny or duplicate beneficiary, you know, billings between Medicaid officers. And what we found, not just in moving from one state to the other, was the snowbirds. You know, summertime in New York, wintertime in Florida. And the, but it, each time, the whole year, those beneficiaries were, were covered by both states. So there was, they were getting services in both states, but at different times of the year, but they were covered the entire year in both states. And we brought that to the attention of the state Medicaid offices and to CMS in multiple studies and in multiple, what we, in, we didn't have MERS, we had program vulnerability reports. And there was a special process to file those things through CMS where they had a an email address to send all program vulnerabilities through. And we worked with our CMS BFLs, again, alphabet soup, business function leaders, to create those program vulnerabilities to make them seem like, to make them more, acceptable to the program vulnerabilities board that would be looking at these reports. And we submitted them on a routine basis, on things on enrollment, these duplicate payment things, coordination of benefits, all of those types of things. UPICs across the country, all five of them, would submit these things. Black hole. We never heard back on any of them, ever. And some of the, with the enrollment ones, we were finding where, providers in New York had multiple PTANs, multiple NPIs that they were using to avoid administrative remedies that were being taken against them. You put a prepay on somebody, all of a sudden they're billing under another number. And it was, and saying, what is the business purpose of them having multiple ones? No one could answer that, but they, they would, it's allowable because the provider wanted it.
Right.
So those types of vulnerabilities at the UPIC level were very important. They were part of our, they were part of the investigators at OIG, part of their performance evaluation.
Right.
They were part of the UPIC's performance evaluation. How many did you get?
Matt, not to interrupt you, but, we would find cases in New York at the time. Queens was a different, they didn't call it Max back then, they were carriers. Queens was a different carrier than the other four boroughs. So back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the Queens carrier was GHI and the other four boroughs was Empire Medicare Services. And one of the common things was Manhattan was a different locality. You got a higher reimbursement for Manhattan than you did the outer boroughs, as they call it. And so it was not uncommon for a provider to set up a shell office in Manhattan, see all their patients in a different borough, and submit the claims as if they were in Manhattan. Now, if you were in Queens, this was going to be, this was a winning strategy because it wasn't the same carrier at the time. So you could be working in Queens, but you submit all your claims through Empire Medicare Services. Now, some of that has been negated by the fact that the MACs are now in larger groups and the UPICs would pick these up theoretically in an investigation, but it's certainly in that same vein of, why does a provider have multiple IDs in the same location? And we've worked on projects here where one provider has three different businesses, and it's, but they're all in the same exact location.
And he's the solo practitioner in all three.
Right. One is, ABC Medical. One is ABC, Medical Services. The third one is ABC Medical Services Provider, whatever it may be. And it's all the same. And it's just that it's like this shell game that that goes on. And so, it's, it all comes back to the data. But let's talk about the fact that, so the Wall Street Journal comes up with this article. It's really nothing more than a reiteration. It's kind of an I told you so article of, what was found. And again, what I've been saying is, do we really need some third party to come in and tell the government and the American people where there's, I'm using the term properly, fraud, waste, abuse, because it's not the other way that they're saying it, but it's fraud, waste, abuse. Do we really need that? Or do we just need to look at yearly OIG studies that show the top 10 unimplemented ones? And I thought I read an article, and I can't remember where I read it, but I thought I read something recently that said, if you look at the past couple of years of unimplemented recommendations across all of the OIGs, it's something like $98 billion with a B dollars. And then if you were to implement them, that there would be that savings. But obviously this is an ongoing problem. And whether anybody likes it or not, it's going to get addressed one way or another. Because now it's made it, you know, it's made its way to, you know, to people that want to hear about what they're looking to do to make these savings. But it does kind of beg the question of, how did anybody not really think that this was a problem? We all knew it was a problem.
Yeah, I mean, for years, we would present this, you know, duplicate payment issue to CMS, similar to what, the, you know, the OIG was finding in their studies. And they would say, too burdensome, too expensive to fix. It's the state's issue. You know, they should control their own membership, not a national issue. They should take care of it. And it was banging your head against the wall. In terms of, you know, oversight, you know, the OIGs, each OIG submits two semi-annual reports every year that have all of their reports that they've done, whether they've been implemented or not. They do a separate report on the top 10 management challenges within their department and what's been done to mitigate those challenges. And I think with HHS, nine out of 10 are CMS related, because that's the, you know, that's the largest entity, you know, and the same challenges every year, you see them, you know, the program vulnerabilities within the benefit. So those are, you know, and then you have GAO doing studies every year. They go across the government looking at those things. So the oversight is there, but it's implementing the recommendations that seems to be lagging. I remember when the ACA was passed, you know, Affordability Act, it had specific things that CMS had to do under law to effectuate the ACA in terms of enrolling of high risk providers that they had defined in the law, doing, you know, criminal background checks, fingerprinting, on-site reviews, all that stuff. For 5, 6, 7 years, the OIG would say, this needs to be done, this needs to be done, this needs to be done. And CMS's response was, can't get to it. You know, so, you know, it is the implementation of the oversight that needs to be honed, and, you know, and not more and more oversight by different people. And the last thing I'll say is, from an SIU perspective, you know, there is no formal process that I know of, but we work at Avise, we work after every case. If there is a pattern of program vulnerability, something within the prior authorization process, whatever it might be, and we bring those things to the attention of the plan, both in meetings orally and through written reports showing the impact of those vulnerabilities across, you know, the plan's billings. And so we make it an important part of our partnership, right, with the plans, and every SIU should be doing that.
And that is part and parcel. I mean, you know, again, we are very strong here about talking about the fact that special investigation units are really an integral part of the collaboration that needs to occur between the payment integrity. We talk a lot about it as being more program integrity, because program meaning the payer, it's the overall thing. It's the policies, it's the procedures, it's enrollment, it's all of that. And SIU kind of becomes the main hub, and everything else becomes a spoke for things that are in that FWA space. And so this is it's an important piece of the puzzle. Now, obviously in the commercial space, you know, this particular type of fraud, waste, abuse scheme is a little bit more of a challenge, because, you know, if you're on a national plan, it doesn't matter where you are. And if you move, there's probably an out-of-state benefit or whatever it may be. This is a really niche issue that is really relegated in the Medicaid space. You don't even see it very much in the traditional Medicare space or Medicare Advantage space, because there is that data sharing that occurs. In the Medicare Advantage space, at least, if I go from Florida to New York and I'm a snowbird or whatever, it's the same Medicare Advantage plan. If it's a traditional Medicare, where it can get a little twisty, is that if I'm spending some of my time in New York and some of my time in Florida, my claims are going to be sent to the MAC, or the Medicare Administrative Contractor, in the location where that service is rendered. And so there is the potential that, you know, you're going to see claims in two different places, but it's still not the same, because you're not making a double payment. The service is being rendered in New York, the service being rendered in Florida. It's part of that same pot of money. This really is a very unique niche thing that occurs in the Medicaid space, because there isn't that purview from state to state to see these things on the state level. And it really isn't something that the states can coordinate or facilitate on their own. They actually do need someone who holds all of the data to be able to facilitate this. And the easiest way to do it is to have the holder of that national data run these metrics and these reports, because it's almost a simple thing. You take a monthly report for your Medicaid rolls, which the state should be able to provide, who are all of the people that are on all of the MCOs in the state of New Jersey. You take for that same time period, who are all of the people that are on the MCO rolls in the state of Florida, and you do a file compare. And I mean, I'm dummying this down, but it really is not that much different. Assuming you've got apples to apples, which TMSIS data is supposed to be, if I know Eric Rubenstein, this date of birth, this social security number, and I've got that information, it's almost like I'm going into two Excel spreadsheets and I'm doing file compare, right? Or common or commonalities. It's almost like a common Benny report. We would do common Benny reports in traditional Medicare. Who are the common beneficiaries between Drs. Rubenstein, Kachansky, and McFall? It's almost no different. So it does beg the question of why is it, in particularly in today's world, when we know that everybody is very interested in artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all of that, how this is something that we can't try to make as a priority, particularly when the TMSIS data has apparently been or allegedly been normalized to be in one place where it all looks the same, where you can have these file compares. So I think this is something that's going to be interesting. This is something that's going to come out, because one of the biggest issues in Medicaid is obviously, does Medicaid police itself properly from an FWA perspective? And we know there are tons of challenges, budgetary-wise, payment integrity-wise. There are a whole bunch of things that are out there that create challenges in the Medicaid space. You know, there are only so many prosecutors. There are only so many investigators. There are only so many cases that can be worked on at a time. But there are definitely things that can be done, because we see this in the Medicare space. We see that the commercial space, 10% estimated fraud per year in healthcare is not something to, you know, to brush off. So we need to take a better look and see where that goes. We're going to continue monitoring this, because this article was an interesting article. More interesting was the fact that it relied upon a study that was already done, and basically saying, hey, look, this is still going on. We know it's been going on since at least 2019. And probably even earlier than that, because data collection wasn't even as good in 19 as it is today. So we're going to keep monitoring it. But for those of you that are in the SIU space, if you aren't in a position where your plan does have a version of a weakness or a program integrity, or what we would call the management implication report, which I thought was always a stupid name. But if we can have something that has an actual name that tells you what it is, because, you know, to me, when I read the term management implication report, meant that Matt Kachansky wasn't doing a good job as a manager. And so we need to have there has to be a name for it that's commensurate with what we're doing. You've got to think about doing that, because that's where that cross collaboration and that teamwork comes into. Again, you want to pay the claims, you want to pay them quickly and appropriately, but, you know, let's find where a provider is identifying a way to circumvent or skirt a policy, a regulation, whatever it may be, that there is an impetus to be able to identify that, tighten it up, and review it. And so we're going to continue to look at this. Our newsletter this week is focusing very heavily on this issue in particular. And so we're going to continue to monitor it. So a couple of people sent us this article, or sent it to me. And so I'm appreciative. They were looking to get what our thoughts were from the OIG roundtable on this one. We got this from a few different people. So it's a good topic for this week. And I think we're going to see a lot more of these kinds of topics over the next few weeks. So we'll continue to address them. We're trying to play that fine line, not make these political conversations. But, you know, everything is political now. So it's a challenge. So as always, good to see you guys. Matt, Wade, always good to have your input on these things and good to get your insights. And for those that tune in every week, again, we always appreciate your insights and your requests for information on what's going on here. And we look forward to engaging with everybody again next week. Again, newsletter comes every Friday to your inbox, and you can get the weekly OIG roundtables delivered right to your inbox, where you can listen to them and watch them and all of that. Also Spotify and on our YouTube channel. So join us, advisehealth.com, advize health.com. And you can sign up for the newsletter and get all that stuff in there each week. So until the next week, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. You're welcome.